Welcome back to the third episode of Pipettes to Patients, the podcast where we bridge the gap between cutting-edge research and real-world patient care. I'm your host, Dr. Simone, a radiation oncologist and researcher, and I'm so excited to share with you this month's episode. Today, we are diving into the world of sarcomas, as July is National Sarcoma Awareness Month. Sarcomas are a rare and very complex group of cancers that begin in the bones or soft tissues, like muscle, fat, or connective tissue. While sarcomas account for less than 1% of all adult cancers, they account for about 15% of cancers in children, making them especially important to recognize and understand. Research is of the utmost importance when it comes to rare tumors, and on last month's episode, we talked a little bit about genetics and cancer. This month's episode highlights an important genetic syndrome that predisposes people to cancer, and it's called Li-Fraumeni syndrome, or LFS for short. This syndrome is like having a broken safety switch in your body's cells. Normally, our cells have a gene called TP53, which you may remember from last episode, and this acts like a safeguard. Its job is to watch over cells in our body to check for damage and then help repair that damage or stop them from growing if they're too damaged, sort of like quality control on an assembly line. People who have LFS have a mutation that causes TP53 not to work properly, and so damaged cells can slip through the cracks and eventually cause a cancer. Over time, this makes it much easier for cancers to develop, and unfortunately, sarcomas are one of the most common types of cancers seen in LFS. Rare genetic disorders and rare cancers are often difficult for scientists to study, which is why physician, patient, and community advocacy is so important in a scenario like this. On today's episode, I had the pleasure of sitting down with Dr. Tim Dameron, a fellowship-trained orthopedic oncologist and distinguished professor of orthopedic surgery here at Upstate, as well as Kathy Higgins, the Education and Awareness Director for the Li-Fraumeni Syndrome Association, to learn about how their worlds collided. All right. Thank you guys for joining us for the third episode of Pipettes to Patients, a podcast focused on how research moves from the bench to the clinic. In light of the fact that it is July and it is National Sarcoma Awareness Month, I have with us today two people who work with sarcomas on a daily basis. So I'm going to have you guys introduce yourselves.
Sure. So Tim Dameron, I'm a professor in orthopedics. I specialize in orthopedic oncology. I treat bone sarcomas and a number of other different types of tumors from a musculoskeletal standpoint. I also do research. So some people would say I'm a clinician scientist.
And Kathy, can you give us an introduction?
Sure. My name is Kathy Higgins. I am the Director of Education and Awareness for the Li-Fraumeni Syndrome Association. I am a patient advocate for families that have Li-Fraumeni syndrome.
So a lot of you out there are probably thinking, you know, why do I have someone coming to talk about Li-Fraumeni syndrome and how is that relevant to sarcoma? Well, on the last episode, which if you didn't listen, I encourage you to go back and listen to, we had the pathologist on, Dr. Jeffrey Ross, and he gave us a really nice summary about a specific gene called TP53, which is a tumor suppressor gene. And Kathy, I just want to, can you kind of shed a little light on what that tumor suppressor gene does and what it means for people with Li-Fraumeni syndrome?
The P53 gene does stop any rogue cancer cells from growing, and it is one of the most important genes in the body. It is also one of the most studied genes in the world because it is so important. A family that is affected with LFS, a patient with Li-Fraumeni syndrome, their cancer suppressor gene, their P53 gene, does not work correctly. So they are exposed to getting any number of cancers. Right now, the spectrum is at about 16 different cancers that the Li-Fraumeni family will get. The most prevalent cancer is breast cancer in our young women. We're the youngest population to get breast cancer. We get breast cancer in our 20s. A person that has LFS, a female, would be almost 100% chance she will get a cancer in her lifetime. Men run it somewhere between 70 and 80% that they will get a cancer in their lifetime. So it's something that is in every cell in our body, so we can get cancer anywhere at any time. So we have to be very diligent in watching for cancer because we can just get it at any time, any place.
one of the types of cancer that patients with Li-Fraumeni syndrome can get is sarcoma. Can you talk a little bit about, I know obviously that's affected you personally, and hence the relationship between you and Dr. Dameron. I do want to talk about that as well. Can you give us a little information about your relationship with sarcoma?
Sarcoma came into our family in 1995. Our 12-year-old daughter had a lump in her leg. I went, took her to the doctor. The doctor did an x-ray, saw that there was some kind of mass on her leg. They did a biopsy. It turned out that she had an osteosarcoma in her leg, and it was recommended that she have chemotherapy and surgery. At the time at the hospital, the local hospital we went to, the surgery option was to remove the limb. Carrie was 12 years old at the time, and I begged them not to take her leg off. We were sent up to Boston for limb salvage surgery. That didn't work very well. We were lucky enough to be introduced to Dr. Dameron, who did a follow-up surgery on Carrie, removed the her thigh bone and any cancer that was in there, and she had a titanium rod and an artificial knee for the rest of her life till she passed away at 30 years old. My husband, 6 months after Carrie passed away in 2014, came down with his first sarcoma. He ended up with two sarcomas, one in his arm and one in his leg, within 8 months of each other. Because of the fact that we knew we had LFS, they were caught early, they were treated, and right now he is cancer-free. Our other daughter passed away at 18 years old of an adrenal cancer back in 2003, and that's where we were diagnosed as having Li-Fraumeni. My husband's dad passed away at 37 from a brain tumor in 1966. His sister passed away in 1993 of three different cancers by the time she was 32. Carrie had gotten cancer when she was 12. Maureen got the adrenal when she was 18 in 2003. And that's when we came into the Li-Fraumeni world from that point.
So Dr. Dameron, Kathy mentioned, you know, having a 12-year-old daughter who came in with a lump on her leg, is that usually a common presentation of sarcoma? What do you find is the most usual thing that you see in the clinic?
Well, sarcomas, you know, we talked about osteosarcoma in your daughter, but there's a whole spectrum of sarcomas. There's soft tissue sarcomas, there's bone sarcomas. So they present in a lot of different ways. So for instance, like a bone sarcoma, like your daughter had, frequently presents with pain. Osteosarcoma doesn't always present with a mass. Ewing sarcoma frequently presents with a mass. It's another common type of bone sarcoma in kids. But then there's the whole other category of soft tissue sarcomas, and those are twice as common as bone sarcomas. And so we see a lot more of those, and those present with a mass and characteristically without pain, which is a little bit of a confusing thing for most people. Most people think, you know, soft tissue mass, if it doesn't hurt, don't worry about it. In fact, there are some physicians that tell patients that, but that's absolutely not true. The vast majority of soft tissue sarcomas that present are with a mass that's not painful. So there's a whole spectrum of how patients present, you know, so you have to watch a lot of different things.
Yeah, so one of the things that you mentioned was that, you know, you can have a mass without pain, and those are very difficult to detect without good kind of screening techniques. In someone who is predisposed to a cancer, right, what are some of the tools that we use to screen those patients? If we know that a patient, let's say with LFS, you know, has a huge risk of developing a cancer, what are some of the things that we can do to?
Well, I think anybody that has a Li-Fraumeni, they get a biopsy for everything. There's no, I mean, any condition where they're predisposed to cancer, I mean, my level of suspicion is extremely high, and I have a very, very low threshold to just, you know, stick a needle in a soft tissue mass or do a bone biopsy. I mean, I think you just have to presume that everything's cancer until proven otherwise. But in terms of the soft tissue tumors in general, in patients that don't have high risk for cancer, we use a couple of things. One is the depth of the tumor. So if it's deeper than the fascia, that's more concerning, and the size. So if it's more than a couple of inches, more than 5 centimeters, you have to be concerned about that. But the vast majority of soft tissue masses are benign. They're superficial, small, doughy, they're lipomas or they're cysts. So it's pretty rare to have a sarcoma. It's a very small percentage of all the soft tissue masses that we see. But those are the two things to watch out for is size. So more than a couple of inches, kind of more than a golf ball size, and if they're deep.
Chemo is used in all sarcomas, some sarcomas. What's the role of chemotherapy in sarcoma?
The biggest determinant as to whether we use anything other than surgery is the grade of the tumor and also whether there's spread. So if there is spread, then, you know, the cat's out of the bag. And so we can't necessarily just cure it with surgery. So in general, and there's some exceptions to this, if it's spread to, you know, multiple sites, then we're going to use systemic treatment because doing surgery, focused surgery on the primary, the thing, place that it started, is not going to cure all those other sites of disease. If it's low grade, then those are the ones that get surgery alone. So if it's a high grade, if it's a soft tissue tumor, if it's high grade soft tissue tumor, chemotherapy is kind of controversial. And in those situations, we always use surgery, we always use radiation. The order in which we do that is a little bit controversial. And the chemotherapy is controversial. But for young patients, osteosarcoma, Ewing sarcoma, those patients always get chemotherapy. That's what's going to save their life. We used to do amputations in all of our patients with osteosarcoma. But still, you know, 80% of them died because it wasn't the tumor that we were giving the amputation for that was killing the patient. It was the spread in other places. So we learned that chemotherapy is, you know, crucial for the treatment of osteosarcomas and Ewing sarcomas. So they always get chemotherapy.
So you mentioned amputation, and Kathy sort of touched on this as well. You know, that used to be standard of care for patients a long time ago. And then this idea of limb sparing came in. Can you talk a little bit about what that means?
Well, I mean, it's pretty intuitive. You know, you either do an amputation or you spare the limb. But it sort of evolved out of that story that I was alluding to. And when osteosarcomas were first treated, everybody got the amputation, thinking that if you get rid of the primary tumor, then you eliminate the source of the spread. But the truth was that the cells had already lodged in different places. We figured out that you can do chemotherapy. And so there started to be, you know, start the chemotherapy right away. And people noticed that, you know, the tumors were responding, they were getting smaller. And so then they become a little bit more aggressive from an orthopedic oncology standpoint at trying to just take out the tumor and save the limb. And then when they looked at the tumor specimens, and they could tell that the chemotherapy was indeed working because a lot of the tumor was dead. And so then it kind of switched to almost everybody gets limb salvage now. It's pretty rare that you need an amputation, but there are certain situations. So for instance, if you have a really huge tumor and it's wrapped around all the vital structures, so say it's in the thigh and it's encasing the femoral artery and the femoral vein, the femoral nerve, the sciatic nerve, or at least, you know, major components of those, then probably you're going to end up having to do an amputation. So every case is different, but there are specific, very narrow indications for amputation these days. For the most part, we approach everything as if we can save the limb.
Kathy, how does that feel to you coming from your personal experience, having a doctor come into the room and tell you that, you know, your daughter has to have her leg amputated, to now it being sort of standard that we are looking at everybody as a limb salvage candidate?
It's wonderful. I'm so grateful that a doctor mentioned that option to me when Carrie was young. Otherwise, I may have had her leg taken off because that we didn't think we had a choice. I'm grateful now because I know even with Dr. Dameron, did he changed Carrie's life. You know, she walked down the aisle when she got married on both of her legs because of what he, you know, his talent and what he did that could have been so different. And I'm so grateful that awareness and education and the way things have changed and progressed has made it to the point where there aren't parents like me that have to make that choice. I'm grateful.
So I just got chills when she said that her daughter got to walk down the aisle because of what you were able to do. You know, obviously there are orthopedic oncologists, right, in most places now, but what's the training like to become an orthopedic oncologist or do what you do?
Right. So it's a subspecialty of orthopedic surgery. So the training for orthopedic surgery is after medical school, you do a 5-year orthopedic residency, and then you graduate as an orthopedic surgeon. But then if you want to do a specialty training in orthopedic oncology, it's a fellowship. So it's at least 1 year of additional training after you finish your 5-year residency. Now, there are some fellowships that require 2 years, but usually one of those 2 years is doing research. So the core is a 1-year fellowship afterwards. But I can say that it's a lifelong learning experience for orthopedic oncology. So it never ends. The learning never ends.
Is that one of the things that you love about orthopedic oncology?
Yep.
I can tell your face lit up when you were talking about it. You also sort of mentioned that you're a clinician scientist. Can you give us a little information about that and what that means to you?
Yeah, I mean, there's so many things about orthopedic oncology I just love. Research is one of them, and I've done research since I got here. Our focus, so I've done a lot of clinical research. I've done collaborative research with people from Sloan Kettering, from Mayo, and then also bench research in the lab and looking at the effects of radiation on bone and the growth plate in kids. Now, I know, you know, Brittany's a big advocate of radiation, but I have to point out to her that sometimes radiation has adverse effects just as it does, you know, good effects on the tumor. So
I agree.
So we've looked at that over the years. And unfortunately, we haven't been able to identify anything that really helps us in mitigating those damaging effects on normal structures.
And Kathy, we sort of, you know, we were able to go out to lunch before this, so we talked a little bit about research, but it was really nice to hear that, you know, there are people out there that are not in basic science that actually are interested in basic science research. Can you talk a little bit about what those sort of granular research topics mean for patients or people like you who are affected by rare syndromes, rare cancers, those sorts of things?
It's actually the driving force of what brought me into advocacy work. When we were first diagnosed with having LFS, we had no clue. We couldn't even say the word for the first 6 months. When I found out there was an organization, I went to my first conference with them, and there was a whole panel of scientists and doctors and researchers up on the stage, and they were all talking about LFS. And I looked at them and I said, every single one of them up there is dedicating their lives to helping people like me. And I never worked outside the home. I'm not a professional, but I just stood up at the end of that conference, and both of my daughters were gone at that point. And I just said, give me something to do. I want to make a difference. I don't want anybody else in the world to go through what we did because they didn't know what I know now. And I've just been loud and proud since 2017. I travel the country now. They put me on the board of directors for the World Organization, and I'll talk to anybody that will listen to me and say, hey, this stuff is important. I go to research conferences. I go to labs. I tell these people, that's the scientists, I say, you know, we're not Petri dishes. You know, I want you to remember my face when you're looking in that, you know, that microscope and you're trying to, I want you to remember, I know you're not a cold-hearted person, but I want you to also remember that everything you do affects lives like my family and the people I love. And I said it at the cancer retreat, that all of those scientists that there, same thing you know, you're out there doing all this stuff, and it's going to come back to help people like us someday, so that my husband, who's got LFS, doesn't have to worry about every pain, every lump, every bump, is it cancer back, waiting for another shoe to drop every minute of every day of his life. If I can motivate people to care about that, to care about 1 in 5,000 people, they think, have what we have now. That's a big number. When we were first diagnosed in 2003, they said there was 400 families in the world that had it. Now it's 1 in 5,000 and 16 different cancers we get. So it's just, I'm just so grateful for anybody that's in that research space that is trying to make a difference in the world, because, you know, someday cancer, there's not a person in the world that isn't affected by cancer somehow. Some doesn't know somebody, isn't personally affected. So I saw this thing one time, and it was said, if you ever saw a child battling cancer, it'll change your life forever. And when I go to these shows and stuff, I have that on my table when I'm talking to somebody. And it's so true, you know, like me watching my 12-year-old daughter just battle cancer or chemo back in 95, it was hell. It was really hell. I don't want anybody else to ever have to do that. So back to research, I'm grateful, and I want people to know that we appreciate everything that they're doing to make cancer go away for everybody.
So Dr. Dameron, you and I both share this clinician scientist title. So I think that we are both attuned to the fact that we can see the faces of the patients that we affect. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, Kathy just mentioned that chemo in 95 was terrible. You see obviously a lot of pediatric patients still and how things go now. What has it been like watching research really affect patients' lives, not only with respect to cancer outcomes, but with respect to quality of life?
I wish I could. You know, I've been to conferences. We go to conferences multiple times every year. And yeah, I mean, there have been improvements and we have refined things. But, you know, the big jump in survival that we made in the 80s and 90s in osteosarcoma and Ewing's due to chemotherapy, we haven't really bumped that up to any substantial degree. I mean, maybe a little bit, but unfortunately, we're sort of in the need of some major breakthroughs to really help improve the survival of patients with sarcomas. And there's a lot of research going on, but I'm optimistic. I think with, you know, some of the things that are going on with the Foundation One testing and tailoring the treatments to specific tumors, as opposed to just lumping, you know, a broad approach to osteosarcoma, Ewing sarcoma, I think that there's good stuff on the horizon. So I hope that stuff pans out. And in terms of the limb salvage procedures, we've gotten a lot better. There are a lot better implants that we have now. We have better imaging. We can be more precise at what we have to take out. And we have, you know, teams that work together all the time now on these sorts of complicated problems. So there have definitely been improvements. I just wish that there were more improvements.
So he says he's optimistic, but he still says he wishes there were more improvements. So with sarcomas, are there certain things about biopsying a sarcoma or certain types of sarcomas that are important? You know, you also mentioned you don't think every lump is a malignancy, but what if you do think it is? Are there things that you take into consideration in biopsying?
Yeah, I have a whole hour lecture on that if you want to.
Maybe keep it brief.
Well, let's put it this way. I had to debate a guy, Dempsey Springfield, who was actually Henry Mankin's partner at Boston, at the New York State Orthopedic Society meeting. Gosh, it's been 15 years ago. And we had to take opposite sides of the question of who should do the biopsy. Should it be the person in the small hospital, you know, that's not an orthopedic oncologist, or should it be referred to the major academic center, either regionally or nationally? And I got the bad side. I got the side of, you know, well, the local guy should do it. And that's not really the way it should be. It should be, at the very least, if somebody in a local hospital is presented with a mass or a possible sarcoma, they need to communicate with an orthopedic oncologist to make sure that the biopsy is done the right way, because there are good articles. In fact, Henry Mankin was the lead author on a couple of them that show that you can, if you do a biopsy poorly, it can result in the need for additional surgery or even amputation in a small percentage of cases. So there are a whole bunch of guidelines as to who should do the biopsy, how they should be placed, how they should be managed. So it's an hour lecture.
And that's one thing also that kind of brings the three of us together, me as the radiation oncologist, you the orthopedic surgeon, and then Kathy, you know, you mentioned that your husband ended up having radiation. Can you talk a little bit about that scenario?
Yes, my husband, 6 months after Carrie passed away, found a walnut-sized lump under his arm, went to the local hospital. They knew we had LFS at that time. The local surgeon said it was a cyst. My husband said, I have LFS. You know, he was very confident. It was the first time my husband hadn't presented with cancer at this point. It was just this lump. The doctor went in, took it out, came out. He was as white as a sheet to me, and he said it wasn't a cyst. It was cancer. So he closed him up. I called Judy Garber up at Dana-Farber, who was handling our family, and I said, Judy, now Jamie has cancer. She said, what did they do? I said, they took it out. No, don't let them touch him again. If it's a sarcoma, it has to be done a certain way. Turns out they didn't take it out the right way. He ended up having to do 5 weeks of radiation up in Boston to put out the fire. He ended up having to have the whole bottom of his arm taken off. They had to do a muscle flap from the back, bring it around. So he had plastic surgery under his arm here. That was in 2014 and 2024. He was up at Boston getting his yearly checkup. He now has cancerous cells in the chest wall because of the radiation from 10 years ago. So now it's coming back to bite him a second time because, like Dr. Dameron said, that tumor or the soft tissue sarcoma was not taken out the right way the first time. Yeah, it's important to speak up. We learned after he had a second one on his thigh, and we ended up going back up to Boston, and they took it out. It was another soft tissue sarcoma, not a metastasis, another primary cancer site. And he didn't have to have radiation for that one. They just removed the sarcoma, and he's had a few minor things since then, but no real cancer because now he's getting his whole body MRIs all the time, so we're catching everything early.
And I think that really speaks to the importance of patient advocacy, which is obviously what you are very passionate about. But not everybody has, you know, an advocate. So just for the listeners, can you, you know, give us a little bit of information about, you know, where they can look to if they're looking for somebody to advocate for them or if they need help with anything related to, you know, LFS?
We do have a website. It's lfsa.org. It is a very comprehensive website. There's everything on there. There's resources on there. There's centers of excellence. Everybody that monitors that site does have something to do with LFS, so it is people that will help guide anybody that needs it. I run the Voices of LFS on Facebook. It's a Facebook group. Nothing but LFS families are on there. Anybody can reach out to me or anybody that's in the LFS community, and we work together to help each other. We don't do any medical advice on any of our sites. That's a big no-no, so that's why I moderate it, to keep that off there. But anybody that would think that there might be a possibility they have LFS, you know, just check the website out and reach out.
So you mentioned that you obviously don't give any medical advice or anything like that. Dr. Dameron, I'm sure that you have patients that go to Dr. Google all the time. What do you say to those patients?
Well, some of them just fess up and say, you know I shouldn't have done it, but I consulted with Dr. Google and it scared me. Honestly, there are less and less patients that put a lot of stock in what they find online, which is refreshing, because there was a phase there where patients that would come in with a, you know, whole bunch of printed out material and they were convinced that they were right about everything. And, you know, a lot of times they are, but it's not real reliable consistently anyway. So I just, you know, I asked him, sometimes I'll just say, well, when a patient comes in to go over a biopsy, did you consult, you know, Dr. Google? Did you look this up online? Do you have any questions about things? Or do you want me to just tell you what I think? And then it usually goes pretty well after that.
And what's it like? I consider myself fortunate in that I don't really treat pediatric tumors, but what is it like interacting with parents of patients? What is different about that?
Well, I'm a father, and it's hard when you know, I mean, you know, there's just nothing like having a child affected by cancer, and I don't know that personally, but I can tell you that at every phase of my career, the patients, the children and their families that I was bothered the most by were when the children were the age of my child at that point in time, because I could see myself in that situation, and, you know, it's that would be very difficult. So I don't know if that answered your question or not.
I think it did. I think it did. It definitely, you know, I see, you know, pediatric patients come through our department, and you see kids that are, you know, the age of your child, and that it's something that's very difficult, I think, for all of us. But we appreciate everything that you do. Tell me, I want to shift gears a little bit. What do you love about Upstate, and what kind of brought you here?
So orthopedic oncology is a very small world. Still today, there's probably, you know, 200, 250 orthopedic oncologists. When I was training, there were only about 125 orthopedic oncologists in the country, and there were only five or six fellowship programs. And so after I did my orthopedic residency and I did my fellowship at the Mayo Clinic, I was looking for jobs, and there were only like a handful of jobs. So I don't want to say that I came here because it was, you know.
It was your only option. Great. It was his only option, everyone.
But, it was definitely the best physician that was available. But the problem was that, you know, I came here, there was no, they had never had an orthopedic oncologist here. And so I had to start from scratch. But, you know, things have really gone well for me. I've had a very, I've had two very supportive bosses, Dave Murray, who passed away last year, and then Steve Albanese. And Steve in particular, over the longer part of my career, was very supportive in terms of research and clinical support. So I can't say enough positive about the institution and the way that they have supported me and allowed me to build an orthopedic oncology program here and to do both lab research and clinical research and still have a very busy clinical practice. So
yeah, I think oftentimes when people think about research, they think about really, really big institutions and the kind of research that comes out of, you know, Dana-Farber, Sloan Kettering, things like that. But in fact, I actually find that some of the collaborations that happen, you know, at smaller institutions can be more meaningful. Have you found that here at Upstate?
It's certainly more fun. And I think because you have a direct interaction. I mean, I've been involved in collaborative studies with major institutions like I alluded to before. And I think those are valuable, but it's very difficult to do that. And I think that when you have a particularly a multidisciplinary team, like, you know, we've collaborated from a radiation oncology standpoint and an orthopedic oncology standpoint. And I think that's very beneficial. I think that can make a lot of progress, you know, just like the big institutions. So I think there's certainly a role for it.
And I want to sort of close out with a little piece of advice from you. So if I were a medical student or thinking about going to medical school, what sort of advice do you give those people? In terms of what should I do with my life? Which specialty should I choose?
I have the best job in the world, but not everybody can get my job. I can help people. I do fascinating research. I do cases that are just, you know, they're a lot of fun. They're challenging. You know, it exercises my brain. You know, not a lot of people are able to do the things that I do. So I'm an outlier probably. You know, because I really like my job.
I really like my job too.
Right, but there's so many people out there that they just have a job. You know, they go to their job and then they go home and, you know, they don't have all the opportunities and all the positive things that we have. So I think I feel very lucky.
Kathy, you mentioned a little bit about, you know, there's a lot of anxiety, you know, surrounding patients that have, you know, patients that have LFS. They know that eventually they will develop some type of cancer. How do your family members, I guess, go ahead and try and take that off their mind and escape from that reality occasionally?
It's always in the back of your mind, but the way my husband describes it, because it's he that has it, is that he walks that fine line between paranoia and diligence and living his life. He looks for bumps and just makes sure that everything is looking okay. He does the two-week rule. If anything looks weird, you know, he goes and gets it checked out. We're lucky that we have a team around us, that Judy Garber up in Dana-Farber, I have her personal cell phone so I can call her and say, hey, Judy, Jamie's got something or whatever. And a lot of our families feel the same way, that they make a personal connection with their doctors and they feel okay to approach them when they have worry. That's one of the main things that we look for when we have LFS doctors, is that they understand what we're going through. That a lump and a bump that's from anybody that doesn't have LFS is okay, but for us, they know that they have to listen to us. That gives us comfort. Being in the community, you know, we went from 2003 to 2016 without ever meeting another LFS person. The first time we met another LFS family was like, they get it. They get it. You don't have to explain to them why you're worried about that mole on your arm that everybody else would say is no big deal, or, you know, why the teenagers are missing all kinds of school because they're going for scans and they're going for surgeries and doing chemo and all of that stuff. And we do keep a specific group of teenagers from 13 to 26 that we specifically target and keep those kids focused and make sure that they understand what their disease means to them for family, what it means to decisions going forward as they grow older and as they transition from being in the pediatric world to being in the adult world. That world in between there is very gray right now. And the parents don't want to give up the control that they have over those their sick kids. But at the same time, there is a cutoff where they have to become adults. And we do teach them how to live under those circumstances. And it's just, it sounds bad, but it's just our reality. And we just try and do the best that we can with it and protect ourselves as best we can.
Right. And I just want to close with one final question, Dr. Damron. What do you think is one common misconception about what you do? I can think of several hilarious memes about orthopedic surgeons that I won't detail, but what do you think is a misconception, you know, that...
That's actually pretty easy because, you know, when somebody gets sent to see me, they come in thinking they're going to see somebody like Darth Vader. Like, I'm going to give them a diagnosis of cancer because I'm an orthopedic oncologist and I deal with cancer. But that's just a misconception because probably 95% of what I see is benign stuff. And so I do the whole spectrum of benign bone tumors, benign soft tissue masses, to malignancies. I see patients from 2 months old all the way up to 102. You know, I see the whole spectrum. And not every time, if you see me, you're not always going to get a bad diagnosis. So that's the misconception.
All right. Well, I appreciate everything you do here at Upstate. I love working with you, love collaborating with you in the lab. And I want to thank Kathy. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy day to be on the podcast. And thank you all for joining us for the third episode. As always, I want to thank you for listening in, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. I have a few key points that I want to make as we wrap it up. While sarcomas are rare, they can be devastating, and I encourage you to visit the Sarcoma Alliance website at www.sarcomaalliance.org to learn more about sarcomas, or if you are a patient or caregiver, there are a number of helpful resources on their website. If you're interested in learning more about LFS, please visit the LFS Association website at www.lfsassociation.org. They also have a number of resources available. Additionally, you can pop over to upstate.edu/cancer/research if you're interested in learning more about the current research happening right here at Upstate. And if you enjoyed listening in today, don't forget to follow us wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for joining us on Pipettes to Patients, where every discovery brings us one step closer to hope. Until next time, stay informed and stay empowered.